Let's turn now to back to beginning of life. I'm going to quickly summarize where we came last week so we can get up to the question of numbers of children. How many children should we have? Is there a biblical norm for that? And the reminder, of course, is that what Van Drunen is doing here is that he is placing the questions about beginning of life as well as all other ethical questions, especially those raised by biotechnology, in the context of the larger Christian life, that is to say, of Christian theology and Christian virtue. And this is where these questions are properly answered by those who are growing in wisdom. There are and in many areas of biotechnology, especially beginning and end of life, there are not necessarily black and white answers. And that's a real key to understanding biblical wisdom on these questions. And so we looked at the nature and purpose of marriage, and we came up with four reasons for marriage that are given in Westminster Confession, chapter 24, which are mutual help, so companionship in the tasks that God has given us, procreation, bearing children generally, and then the third thing is to bear children particularly for the church. For Christians, we bear children in order to raise up a holy seed, and then fourth, to prevent sexual impurity. And then he went over each of these, and we talked specifically about the one that might be a little bit more controversial, and it's interesting that the confession puts it in negative terms, to prevent sexual impurity. And he said, you know, does that imply that sex is somehow itself sinful? And the answer, of course, to that biblically, and this was something the Puritans very clearly understood when they wrote this, that within marriage, it is a wonderful gift of God, something to be enjoyed. Song of Solomon, we know all about that very positive view of sexual intimacy within the bounds of marriage, and that was what the Puritans pushed. Interestingly, as a little footnote, Puritan, it's oftentimes, if you have high sexual norms, it's called puritanical. Well, what that often means is kind of a prudish attitude towards sex. And I remember I had been raised to hear that term used in that way, so I didn't have a very high view of Puritans. And then when I became a Christian, I began to read things like something, in fact, that Robin has just re-looked at. It's a wonderful book by a non-Christian scholar named Edmund S. Morgan, famous Yale historian, called The Puritan Family. And I remember reading that. A friend of mine gave it to me, and reading that book and saying, wow, these Puritans were not at all puritanical. They were hearty. They loved the lives that God gave them. They enjoyed their sexual lives. There's a wonderful story of the Puritan governor, John Winthrop, ordering a special garter from England, from London, for his wife. And so these were things that reminded us that they were not, did not have a negative view of sexuality at all. And the whole of life was to be enjoyed. They appreciated the creation order of things. And so puritanical, oddly, does not apply to the real Puritans, if you look at who they were in history. Leland Ryken, a retired professor of English at Wheaton, has written a wonderful book called Worldly Saints. And I would highly recommend that one if you want to get a good view of what the Puritans actually believe. Because remember, it was the Puritans that wrote our Westminster Confession. And so we have a vested interest in understanding something of who they were as well as what they believed. And so we saw that the way in which the covenant with God and our bearing his image relates to marriage, the marriage covenant, is this, that it was to be perpetual until death, intimate, including sexually, and exclusive. Hence the prohibition for adultery. So that is the way in which the marriage covenant mirrors our relationship with God, which is to be also perpetual, intimate, and exclusive. And that's why the Lord in the Old Testament brings the charge through the prophets, a covenant lawsuit, an indictment against God's people. And he says, you have committed spiritual adultery by going after the idols of the nations and not being loyal, exclusively loyal to me in a perpetual and intimate relationship. Then we saw that one of the dangers of, we saw too a couple of phrases that, well, he uses the phrase family friendly. We could add to that family integrated when that is used as a sort of a byline for churches. It has, no one would ordinarily think of that in a negative way, and yet people who are single would see that as not necessarily being very friendly toward them, as if the only way that one can truly serve the Lord is in the married state. And so Van Drunen makes a strong case for us to be sensitive to the fact that the Bible, in fact, makes a strong case for the usefulness of the single state. And, of course, the most useful person in the Bible who was never married is the Lord Jesus himself. And that's something we should never forget. Some people might say, well, you really can't image God unless you're married, right? It seems that that might be a logical conclusion from Ephesians chapter 5, where Paul ends by relating the mystery of marriage is related to the mystery of the relationship between God and his people. And yet one would not dare say that Jesus did not image his God, because he did so perfectly for us. Paul, of course, is another example, and we noted that 1 Corinthians chapter 7 is an excellent, strong case for the usefulness of the single state. And we explored also the fact that barrenness in the Old Testament is interesting, and I had never noticed this, but Van Drunen says there's no concern with barrenness in the New Testament, but in the Old Testament it's there constantly, and oftentimes it takes God's his supernatural intervention to overcome barrenness, which is a reminder that only he can bring the Messiah into the world, so that the concern for barrenness was a particularly messianic concern, because it was the desire for every covenant woman that she be the one to bring the seed of the woman into the world who would crush the head of the serpent. And so he says it's not accidental then that in the Pauline epistles there's no mention of barrenness as being the same kind of curse that it was in the Old Testament, and which is very interesting. And then he goes and asks this very provocative question, which is more important, the spiritual family, which is the real focus of the New Testament, or the natural family? And, of course, he comes up with the answer from Jesus when Jesus in Matthew 10 talks about hating mother and father and brother and sister out of loyalty to the Lord. And, of course, it's hyperbole, but meant to show that our first loyalty is to the Lord Jesus and his spiritual family, not the natural family. So this really, it upends everything that we would assume, and it teaches us something different than oftentimes even Christians do in our, or teach in our circles. And yet, it's interesting, we also ask something that he doesn't really mention in the book, but why is it that we maybe have overemphasized the natural family? Why is it? And, of course, the answer is because the world almost completely ignores the structure of the natural family, which in turn is the analogy on which the spiritual family is based. And so if you look, for example, at the Timothy, 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus, what are often called the pastoral epistles, where Paul talks about the structure of the church, the way we are to do church, as it were, the government of the church, that Paul structures, he calls the church the household of God. That's a word in the ancient world and in the Greek that would have referred to family structure, to the household structure. Of course, it usually meant more than just the nuclear family. It would have included the larger circle of family as well as servants in the ancient world. But the household, the natural household, now he's saying there's a new household. It's called the spiritual household. And that's where you have elders who are fathers, as it were, of the church. And so we have, and he refers to mothers, really. He refers to the older women as those who should disciple the younger women. And so you have that family structure. The natural family is transferred to the supernatural family. And that's what gets the priority in the New Testament. And then we went on to talk a little bit more about he talks a little bit more on page 103 about the single state and Paul's recommendation that it is a peculiarly useful way of serving the Lord. And then we move to considerations which bring us almost up to where we are. Preliminary reflections on procreation and making this very interesting distinction. And in fact, if you notice, procreation, the word has been replaced in much literature on this subject, even Christian literature, with reproduction. So it's interesting. Procreation refers, of course, more to the natural relationship of a husband and wife, which brings forth children. And then reproduction is something that we produce. And so it definitely signals a more humanly controlled idea than the word procreation. Very interesting. And so he also makes this distinction, therefore, between unitive and procreative aspects of marriage, and saying that now, for the first time in history, making babies doesn't require sex necessarily because of biotechnology. And in fact, one can have sex because of biotechnology without the fear of having babies. And of course, we know the negatives of these things, but then the question is, for those who are married, what do we make of these technologies, and are there ways in which Christians may use procreative technologies in a way that doesn't undermine God, the created purpose in our lives as Christian spouses? So what he says, he asks an interesting question, and we're coming right up to where we left off last week. Why is there no uniform Christian answer to this development? And the answer he gives is very important for us as we learn to do biblical ethics in a wise way, because he says there are two biblical lines of reasoning that seem to conflict, and that we have to take them both into account. I would think of it more in terms of a kind of, they put a pressure on our decision-making, which requires us to consider both of them always at one time. One is that natural procreation is meant by God to be part of the natural process of the marital relationship. But at the same time, he's also given us human beings, made in his image, the ability to control the natural environment. And that's a good thing. It's something that he's told us to cultivate the earth. And we build houses so that we don't get snowed in the winter. We don't go hibernate like bears, because we're made in God's image. And so we build houses, we make clothing, we invented seat belts and cancer-fighting medications and treatments. These are all part of a God-given ability that has been given to man. So what we often see this, and this is interesting, even in food, you see this all natural. Those are things we ought to always ask, what does that mean, all natural? Do you just let your chickens run wild throughout the city of Manchester, or do you have cages? Do you feed them certain types of food? Do you control them in any way? Well, those are important questions to ask. We bandy those terms around as if everyone just assumes what they are. People do assume. That's why they're used in sales. But natural and artificial should not necessarily be pitted against one another the way that we often do. In fact, thank God for artificial things, though that might not be the happiest word, but thank God for the creations of man that God has enabled us to produce, because they make life much more bearable, especially in a fallen world. And so then that question needs to be asked when it comes to the question of how many children should we have. He asks that, as reminds us that this book is meant for, not meant for theologians or academics, it's meant for us, the people of God. How many children to have? And he knows, of course, that this is a real question out there in Christendom. And the question, of course, relates to several things that we find in the New Testament. And he asked this question, or I'm asking this question, the text brings it up. Does the New Testament affirm the goodness of having children? Does it affirm the goodness of having children? And if so, where? When I go into the hospital, by the way, when I'm able to do this, and I try to do it at least with first children, I always read Psalms 127 and 128. And it's because I believe in the goodness of bearing children. It's a wonderful gift of God. And so Jesus blessing the children in the gospel accounts would be a wonderful example of that. And he even uses little children as an example of the simplicity of our trust in the Lord, that's a model for us. Now, we're not to be children in other things, but in terms of simplicity of trust, we are. That's one of the great things that blessing of the children teaches us. So having children is an inherently good thing. Why is it, though, that we might be tempted to say that we ought to have as many children as physically possible? What is it about the modern world that would lead Christians to affirm that statement, that the Christians, according to the Bible, are supposed to have as many children as physically possible? He doesn't say physically there, but I want to say, I'd like to add that word as a modifier, because I think to say possible, it's what I often recommend, that we ought to have as many children as possible, taking all other things into account that he's going to bring up here in a moment in the book. But why do you think that is, Jen?
I think it's a reactionism.
Exactly. So the world, we see the world devaluing children, and even, you know, it's odd. In some ways, the world ends up worshiping children, kind of a romantic notion. We should be like, you know, be free like children. And, you know, there's this ideal of adolescence, which we actually do see now reflected in adulthood, sadly, or the perpetual adolescence of the modern world. But on the other hand, we also hate children because we abort them. And we have birth control for selfish and sinful reasons. In fact, I can remember having a discussion years ago when we had, I don't know that we've had Rebecca yet or not, but we were just in the beginning of the childbearing period of marriage, and we were with some relatives and some friends of relatives that we'd never met before, and they were all talking about how important it was to have only go as far as replacement, I think was the word that was used. Replacement children. It's like even using that word was just such a mechanistic understanding of what was going on. From that point, it was part of a number of things that made us say we should at least have three, just not to follow that foolish way of thinking about having children. In fact, three is what we ended up choosing to have. But I think that is a reaction which is a good instinct. In other words, we see something that's very bad, something that's sinful and evil there happening in the world around us, and so it's a reaction to that. The question is it a completely wise reaction? Jim? Yeah, very, very good point. In fact, it's not something he mentions here, but he could, a good footnote on that would be interesting under his consideration of financial, because where for us, it might, you know, finances and debt might move us to limit the number of children in the agricultural world and in an agrarian culture. Having as many children as you physically could possibly have might end up being financially very important in order to run the farm. You know, I always thought that having three kids would be enough to get the driveway shoveled, but I was mistaken in that. And now when we need them most, we have to get a snowblower. Grandchildren, there's still hope. But in any case, so this raises, and so there are these considerations, and so we're now in a place where we have to ask this important question. And he makes an interesting statement there on page 106. He says that most streams of Christian tradition, however, have denied that God places an obligation upon married couples to bear as many children as possible. And I think he's saying there as is physically possible to have. And so he also, if you go back, he makes a statement, even if it is not the only acceptable way of life, having children is a good thing, and it is the course that Paul recommends for most young women, and thus necessarily for most men as well. But I think his point there at the top of that page is that it's not the only way to serve the Lord to have children, period. And then the question is, should we have as many as possible? And then over at the end of that page, he really makes some important distinctions, some very important distinctions. He says, consider first the initial command that God placed on the human race to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Now, there are two things that he brings to our attention here that are very important, because if you just take that at first blush, and I would say if you take it in an unwise way, you would say, it says you should have as many children as physically possible. But he points out at least two things that would make us doubt this or modify our understanding of it. He says, number one, first of all, it was given before the fall, and it was given to all mankind. And so it doesn't mean that every single individual is responsible for having as many children as possible, but that the whole race as a whole is to multiply in order to fill the earth. And I think the human race, with all of its wickedness, has done a fairly good job of that up to this point. And we have people like Malthus, who was, by the way, a clergyman in, I think, the 18th century, raising the cry of the population explosion. And then, okay, so there's the one. It's not meant that every single individual needs, therefore, to have as many children as possible. But what is the second exhortation is one that's so important, or the second dimension of this question, of the answer to this question, over on page 107. What is the other thing that we need to consider in a general command like this, to be fruitful and multiply?
Stewardship.
Yeah, well, if you understand stewardship as fulfilling various duties at different times, and different people are responsible for fulfilling them. So here's the idea. He says this, and I think this definitely comes from his study of law, but positive exhortations are often not meant to require constant observance. Is it ever sinful to read your Bible? Sounds like it's a trick question. It really is. Because what you think ought to be the answer is not the answer. Yes, it is sinful. If I'm working and I'm reading my Bible when I'm supposed to be watching planes land at Logan Airport, I am sinning because I'm not paying attention to my God-given calling of being an air traffic controller. So I put it in an extreme example to make a point. that it's, we worship one day in seven. We worship. Now, it's not the only time we worship the Lord, but it's the only time that we publicly worship ordinarily. And the Lord set aside a whole day because he created us to work. That's what we're supposed to be doing the other 6 days, essentially. Now, it's important, of course, to be taking what we, the worship of Sunday, and bringing it into the week in terms of our daily devotions, beginning and end of day, and that kind of thing. But the fact is that it's appropriate to do certain things at certain times. Worship the Lord is a general commandment. Be fruitful and multiply, but it doesn't mean that it's the only thing we do, or that all people are required to do it. So he says, for example, children, the elderly, husbands, wives, ministers, lay people, we all have different duties. So different people, different times require different fulfillments of the general positive commands of Scripture. Then on page 107, and I put this in bold caps in my text because I think it's a very significant statement. It's the only thing I've done up to this point in 100-something pages, the only sentence that I have noted in this particular way, because I think it's so important. He says, about the middle of 107, the key principle is that married couples' procreative life ought to be carried out thoughtfully and in harmony with the full range of their responsibilities. Okay, so it's in that light. In other words, it's the context that he's not only setting ethical questions and here about how many children in the context of Christian doctrine and Christian virtue, but also the context of particular Christian lives. And wisdom needs to take those things into account. And so what are those things? And notice he says, as a caveat, right at the top of page 108, there's no single correct answer to this question, how many children should I have? It would, you know, if you want to think of biblical numbers, it would be 3, 7, or 12. And so that was a joke. That's why we chose 3. No. And a quiverful, as Spurgeon once said, will make you quiver before they're a quiverful. And that's actually 4. So, that's right, they are. And, of course, that's a metaphor in the Old Testament. It's right there in those Psalms, 127, 128, that they will speak with the enemy in the gate. So much like in the agrarian culture, in the culture of walled towns and cities, having children actually was part of your defense system. You know, you didn't have Brinks alarm systems. You had kids, and that was strength. That was your strength. And it wasn't just for protection, but it was the strength of a family and a culture in the ancient world. I think that has not changed. It's the strength of the church that we have children, and it's a wonderful blessing to have so many of them running around and on their way into the world. But the question then is, what are the things that we should be considering in our decision making? And the first thing he puts there, and we might think this unspiritual, but we shouldn't, because the Bible has a lot to say about our use, our stewardship of money, is money, finances. That's a very important question. Now, I will say that my parents could not afford to pay for my college education when I was 18. I was on my own, and I never thought anything of it. There were a couple kids that I knew who were wealthy, and their parents put them through college. I don't remember them doing particularly well in a couple of cases because I think they were spoiled a bit, but it's not to say that it's wrong to put your kids through college. If I could have afforded to do it, I would have at least helped them a little bit more than we've been able to. But we never thought, oh, you've got to have $100,000 for each kid in the bank before you can have children. The world would be depopulated, I think, especially in today's economy. But there's that thinking now. And plus the fact that the first child that we had at home cost us $250 to have. And the last child, which we had to have with a C-section, was something close to 6,000, which back in the day would have been about a quarter of our annual salary. So it was a significant amount of money. And, of course, that's only gotten worse. And health insurance is costly. So there are other, you know, things have changed financially. But the point here that he's making is that staying out of debt is something that is a biblically important principle. Proverbs is loaded with exhortations, and so is the New Testament. Romans chapter 12 and 13 have something to say about debt that Paul mentions. Actually, I think it's in chapter 13, and so it's a very important consideration. Then he mentions one that I never would have thought of if I was giving the list of things to consider, although when I think about it, we had our first baby a year before I went to seminary, and then our second came just after I had graduated. And so he says education. Both spouses are pursuing further education. And incidentally, under finances, he says that if we stay out of debt, we will be able to fulfill another biblical obligation, which is to leave an inheritance for our children. Now, that could be overdone, of course. It can spoil children, as we see plenty of examples of that. But at the same time, that is a biblical goal, Proverbs 13:22. And then he makes the point that by thinking of continuing education and completing it before really having most of your children, or beginning even to have children, is a way of preparing for the future. And, of course, in a highly industrialized and technologized society, that has become even more important. Getting an education is directly linked, in most cases, to income. And so that's a consideration. Thirdly, the importance of training, discipline, and instruction of children. This is a huge undertaking. I went to lunch with our son Tom right before little Rachel Esther was born, and we talked about children and, you know, asked him, you know, how are you feeling about this? And he says, well, Dad, I'm kind of scared. You know, this is scary. I said, good. That's good. You know, it's like the doctor checking your heart rate, and yep, this is the way you ought to be feeling before you have children. It's very important to be concerned because it is a huge responsibility. And then, of course, we talked about trusting the Lord. It's the Lord that builds the house, Psalm 127. And so we had a good discussion about that. But it is a big responsibility. It's very important. Not everyone is able by temperament or, you know, other factors to raise the same number of children that some other people might be able to. And so, again, it's a consideration. And again, there are no exact answers. We're not talking about numbers. We're talking about wisdom. And in our case, and I think I would recommend this, that what happens is that you go along and you take one child at a time. I can remember our daughter always saying she wanted six children, and she now has two, and she's found two to be quite a handful, and especially little Owen. They're tough to keep up with, and so it modifies your way of thinking as you go along, and so you need to take one child at a time and see how the Lord blesses you in other dimensions of your life. And then the fourth thing, and this is actually the final consideration, and not that this is exhaustive, but I think he covers some important bases here, is the potential for a mother's health. And I think that's a very important one. And it's not just, does it have to be, is it going to be life-threatening? That's probably obvious to most Christian couples. But is it generally going to be good for the mother's health? And you can see some mothers just can only have so many children before it begins to really wear them down. That might be not just physical health. It might be mental health as well. And those are very important considerations. Jen? Yeah, that's an excellent point, Jen. And we've had a similar experience in that we didn't come from broken homes, but we came from, broken in the sense of being divorced. We're all broken in another sense because of sin, but we came from non-Christian homes, essentially. So we didn't have that covenantal example that we have in the church. And so we've learned a lot about just being Christians as well as being husband, wife, and mother and father as a result of that. So that's, yeah, that definitely impinges on your decision-making in these areas. Now, what are the dangers of controlling conception? What are some of the dangers? We talked about those earlier, but what's the one big danger that stands out of controlling conception? What would be a really bad motive? Selfishness, luxury. You know, I actually know people, I've known several people that have actually told me, I mean, they're being honest, that's nice, but their motives are not very good, that, you know, we had limited our children. I even know one man that I worked with in architecture that said they weren't going to have children because, well, it's such a horrible world. That's, I think, was a ruse in his case so that we can have, you know, the second home, the snowmobiles, and the new cars every year. So that was the main reason, luxury. And, yeah, that's a temptation. We're selfish by nature, and so it's a temptation. And it certainly would be a bad reason for controlling conception, to live a lifestyle of luxury. And so while on the one hand, it's very important to make sure that having children is not going to get us into a financial mess, at the same time, we shouldn't make the fact that we will not be able to live luxurious lives keep us from having children. And, you know, I look back at our own lives, and we lived on a shoestring. We weren't in debt. That was good. But, you know, if we had waited, I had a friend that said he wasn't going to get married until he had $10,000 in the bank. Now, in the 60s, that was a lot of money. It still is. But I laughed at that because we had zero in the bank, but we had no debt. And so you go and you have children, and staying out of debt is important. But on the other hand, if you want to live a life of luxury, that would be a bad motive for Christian couples. And he says at the bottom of page 110, he says, there's never a perfect time to have children. And I think those of us who have children can certainly testify to that fact. And in fact, sometimes that first child is a complete surprise. And it's not a perfect time from your perspective, but from the Lord's, it certainly is. Well, I have friends that could not have children. They chose not to adopt. I think I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago. And they've had just some of the most insensitive comments made by other Christians, as if somehow they're less than spiritual because they've not had children. Oh, about having too many children. That's right. Oh, especially in the culture, but it can happen in the church as well. So being judgmental is definitely something that we have to keep under wraps, because in fact, if there are no black and white answers, we're not in a good position to make judgments. Now, if someone does something that's overtly sinful, even there, we're to apply grace to it. But these are matters where there is not a clear biblical answer, 3, 7, or 12. And so, that's right. And so, but it means that we are to exercise prudence in terms of the way that we make these judgments about the number of children to have. And I think, as Jim said, sometimes the Lord intervenes in ways that you can't predict. And so we accept that, but that doesn't also mean that we're not to be prudent in making decisions. And also because it's a matter of wisdom and prudence, it's something that's going to vary from couple to couple, from family to family, and therefore something that we should not judge. Now, he brings us down on page 111 to this question of having no children at all. Is that something that's possible? And this is not can't have children and choose not to adopt. That's a different category. But choosing not to have children and using birth control in order to make sure that happens, or to try to make sure that happens, is that in fact biblical? And, you know, our instinct would be to say no. But as he says, if it's okay, if it's biblical to put off having children until it is prudent, based on these Christian principles and decision-making, then why can't you do that indefinitely? And what might be some of the reasons that one would do this? And he was saying, for example, that there would be physical danger or continued travel, just something required in the calling of the people that get married. I knew a man in New Rochelle who had married a former nun. They were married rather late in life. And he was a CIA agent. And so he felt, he actually came to me and said, I'm feeling like he was in a very dangerous operation, which I won't mention, but he said, they had a child, and he said, I feel badly now because I feel like I'm endangering being married and having a child now. And so he concluded after we talked that he should get out of what he was doing, which he did. And so that would be one decision. But he might have made a decision to say, you know, this is my calling in life. I feel the Lord wants me to do this, and therefore it's not going to be wise for us to have children. That might have been a decision that he would have made. I think I would have still recommended that he get out of what he was doing because it was dangerous, and he was married. He had a wife. If he was single, that might be different. It might have been a good reason to stay single. But he made that choice, and I think in his situation it was a wise choice that he chose. And it meant making a lot less money over the next several years, but he did it out of love for his wife and his children, and I think for the Lord as well. And then serious genetic disease. I've known several examples of this where you know genetically that a certain disease that is hereditary in your family is going to come up one out of every two children or something, or one out of six or whatever. Would that mean having no children? Again, it might for some couples. Or I've actually have counseled one couple to not to have no children, but maybe they, you know, at a certain point, if this makes them extremely anxious, to have maybe not as many as they might have had. And they've chosen a certain number, and that's seems to be a wise thing for them. But again, those are considerations. At the same time, he says that we need to be very careful. Of course, they can do all kinds of predicting. I have a friend that they actually discovered this child was hydrocephalic. It would be severely handicapped. The doctor said, you should have an abortion. They said, we believe that would be sinful. We're bringing this child into the world, and this child is no less valuable because severely handicapped. And now I think this little boy, Jeremy, is what? He's got to be 30 now. And it's been it's been difficult. But they've loved this little boy, and he developed far more. This was interesting. They predicted, you're going to have him institutionalized. That was the next thing. And they said, well, we do have an institution for this child. It's called Our Family. And they went on and had a lovely girl, and she had no physical handicaps. And so they've had a lovely family, and Jeremy is still with them and developed far more than they predicted he would develop. So they really weren't able to completely understand what love and nurture could do with this little severely handicapped child. And so that's an important note that he makes. And then he asked the question, are couples who actively seek to prevent having children stunted? I don't think we need to go into that in any great length. And then what we'll do, because we're out of time, is we'll briefly look at methods of birth control. And you'll see that they fall into a couple of categories, those that would be legitimate and those that actually take life in its most basic formative stage, and that would be certainly illegitimate. We'll briefly cover that next week if you have any questions, and then we will begin week 7 on the 8th week. So don't follow the syllabus anymore. We're 1 week behind, and that's okay.